Meanwhile, Brian Walsh is, like many others, working from home. He's former international editor for Time magazine. He's now the future correspondent for the news website Axios. He's also the author of a book called End Times, A Brief Guide to the End of the World, which came out last year and looked at a range of worrisome events, including a pandemic. He's with me now. Hi, Brian.
Hi, it's good to be here.
I do want to talk about how you envisage the world changing and possibly with some attention to President Trump's declaration of a state of emergency. I'm hoping that this pandemic is not exactly what you foresaw in your book as meaning the end of the world.
Yes, I think, you know, we can be pretty confident that's not the case. You know, even some of the pandemic simulations that I wrote about in the book and I've written about elsewhere, you know, had diseases that were just much more deadly. I mean, that one plus of this coronavirus is that, you know, the fatality rate is, you know, the most recent estimate I saw was 10 times higher than the seasonal flu, which obviously is much worse than flu, but not something that's going to end the world. But I think just showing or seeing the sheer amount of changes, the impact it's having around the world in terms of the way we live, the way we work, kind of gives you a sense of what devastation and dislocation would happen if this were even worse. Is it going to be bad enough as it is?
Any comment on the national emergency declared by President Trump? Do you think that that is going to concentrate people's minds?
Well, I certainly think it's going to further concentrate people's minds. We've really seen here in the U.S. where I am just over the last few days, suddenly this event, this pandemic really hitting home, really becoming real for people. Just since Wednesday, we saw, you know, sports leagues postponed or canceled. We saw schools close, people forced to work from home. And really this this announcement, this declaration is, I think, the culmination of that. It's going to unlock, I believe, as much as $50 billion U.S. in federal aid that will be disbursed to states, to municipalities, to help them deal with the impact of the coronavirus. It also sort of loosens some of the regulations around, I think, health care, health goods, in terms of allowing hospitals to sort of take the path that they think is most efficient in terms of treating as many people as possible. But that said, there are obviously still enormous complications, obstacles to dealing with this outbreak here in the U.S., to really catching up to where we should be. While this declaration is welcome, it comes rather late, and it really is coming after a number of weeks where the president was, I think, really downplaying the full extent of this outbreak in a way that allowed the U.S. to, or forced the U.S. really to lose a lot of time that we could have spent preparing for this and maybe doing a better job of preventing it from gaining the foothold it now has.
Let's look at previous pandemics and whether they changed the world. Mm-hmm. I think you've looked at things like the Black Death in the 14th century. What effect did that have?
Well, the Black Death, really probably still the greatest, or worst, I suppose, disease outbreak we've had in human history. By some estimates, may have killed as many as a third of Europe's population during the 14th century. The impact of that, of course, was suddenly far fewer workers, and that eventually led to an increase in wages for those who were still surviving, which then in turn helped push towards labor-saving innovations, and in part to cut those costs, and then also in turn helped lead really to the end of feudalism. So that's one historical event where we really saw a major disease outbreak have a huge impact on history. Other times, you know, after the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic, that was a major event, you know, tens of millions of deaths. At the same time, it really didn't quite have the same impact as some of the others. In fact, it's something historically that tends to be forgotten, in part because World War I was happening at the same time. But I think if anything like that were to happen now, in a much more globally interconnected world, the damage, the history would be far greater than what we saw then.
I suppose that's the thing, isn't it? Our globally connected world. This could be the end of globalization. What do you think?
I mean, certainly it's going to change what we think of as globalization. Really the last, I would say, couple decades or longer have been defined by increasing freedom, for the most part, of movement of people, movement of capital. And that's had a lot of positive effects in terms of alleviating poverty in much of the world. But we're now seeing in some ways perhaps the negative consequences of that. A more interconnected world means that diseases can spread much more quickly. And what we have now is we realize we need to shut things down, stop movement, stop work to a certain extent, stop schools, all in an effort to try to slow the spread, to flatten the curve, as they say, of this pandemic. Despite all our medicine, despite all the technology we have at our disposal, we're really in some ways back to what our ancestors would have had in terms of dealing with these kind of diseases. Just stay away from each other in an effort to slow down its spread. And I think, you know, this will likely last for months. And I can't imagine that we'll go back to the same world that we had before this disease began.
Did the SARS outbreak have an effect, or did it not go on long enough?
Well, the SARS outbreak is kind of a parallel, but different, in that it was much more limited in terms of the number of cases, in terms of its geography. I was in Hong Kong during the SARS outbreak, and I can assure you that it had a gigantic impact there, in terms of just stopping the economy altogether, in terms of the public fear, in terms of the economic effect, you know, which was measured ultimately for much of Asia and globally in the tens of billions. But SARS was not a very transmissible disease. That's really what makes it different from the coronavirus. Once we figured out how it was transmitted, it was fairly easy to slow and then ultimately contain and snuff out. That's not possible, coronavirus. Maybe it was never possible, but certainly given how slow we were to respond to it, it's definitely not possible now. And the impact we'll see from this is going to be far greater than what happened after SARS.
It's interesting. I think that I should have talked to this, to Chris Smith about this, but I think that SARS, if you had SARS, it was more evident, and therefore, I mean, you had more symptoms, therefore it was easier to identify the infectious people. And that's the tricky thing about this one in part, isn't it?
I think that's absolutely true. You know, SARS was a very deadly disease. About 10% of the people who contracted it died. Even many of those who survived were often in intensive care, required respirators for a long period of time. It also, you know, you didn't shed as much virus. And so you often see that kind of relationship with infectious disease. Often the ones that are most deadly, imagine this one, SARS, Ebola, for instance, are actually quite difficult to transmit, which is thankful, and also makes sense from an evolutionary perspective. A pathogen ultimately simply wants to spread, copy its genetic material, doesn't just want to kill you. So in some ways, the fact that coronavirus is less deadly is part of what allows it to spread more easily, but also makes it that much more difficult to stop.
So the coping mechanisms that we are faced with having to use in order to cope with COVID-19, working from home, for example, do you think that'll stay with us? I mean, if we can work from home, why won't we always work from home?
I certainly think you'll see this heighten the transition that was already happening in many places. You know, increasingly more of us are working from home. Sometimes it's part-time, sometimes it's full-time. Companies are looking, especially if they're based in very high-cost cities, like San Francisco in the tech industry or New York here for media, if you're able to use a distributed workforce and the technology increasingly exists that you can do so because it helps you reduce your costs, helps give you more flexibility for your workers. I think we'll see that, you know, not all the business travel we do is all that necessary. Not all the conferences perhaps we go to are all that necessary. That said, one thing I've been thinking over the last few days is that this experience of being isolated, of that social distancing that we need to do, is going to be very traumatic. You know, we're going to see high levels of anxiety. And I do wonder if, when this is over, you might see a bit of a bounce back. You might see people being, I want to be out there with people. I want to go to the office, if only because, you know, eventually you go a little bit mad being by yourself all the time.
You're covering your options there.
I think so, as much as possible. I mean, having only worked from home for a few days now,
you're going crazy,
are
you?
Well, yes, that and our 2.5-year-old, my wife and I's son, his preschool was just canceled, so we're going to have to figure out what to do with him for the next few weeks as well while trying to work. So, and that's an experience a lot of people in the U.S. and around the world, I think, are going to have.
Yeah, have fewer children, perhaps, might be the
answer
to that.
That's one option, I suppose.
You've pointed out, I think, that the video conferencing company Zoom has been one of the few stocks to rise, even as the rest of the market is sinking like a stone. Is that continuing to be the case? I imagine it is.
It has mostly continued to be the case. I mean, everything is being weighted down somewhat by the up and down and mostly down market we've seen. Zoom is a good example of a company. You know, we often see this actually, you know, crises. There are always going to be some companies that end up making the tools that we really need to survive and to fight back. You know, we never had something like this before. You know, in SARS, for instance, video conferencing barely existed. It was not something you could just do on your computer. And so I think what this will do more than anything else is make a far greater number of people and companies very familiar with this technology, which will benefit it over the long term. You also see the same thing, I think, with telemedicine, teledocs, things, companies like that that offer medical care that can be done remotely. Those will definitely benefit. And again, you will see companies get used to it. You will see people get used to it. And if it's convenient, which, it has been to a certain extent, it will stick around, I think, after the fact.
What about supply chains?
Yeah, supply chains are interesting. You had mentioned sort of that era of globalization and freedom of movement that we had before. Mm-hmm. And a big part of that economically was the ability to build long, complex supply chain that were really prioritized for efficiency and low cost most of all. Obviously, China was a huge beneficiary of that. What I think you'll see from talking to people now is that you'll look to build supply chains that are more resilient, which means they're capable of responding to disruptions. And those disruptions aren't just pandemics necessarily. Of course, climate change, natural disasters, those will only worsen over time. And you need a supply chain. You want to build one that is as resilient as possible, that will not be shut down by an external event if you can. That might mean building closer to home, perhaps, in the future. Increasingly, we have technology like 3D printing that might allow companies to actually make many of the components they might need on their own, which would really change things hugely. But I do not think we'll go back to the era of just these incredibly complicated supply chains, because we've just learned how vulnerable they really are to disruption.
I'm just wondering whether there are any geopolitical implications. I mean, China, having been identified as the source of the virus, is now accusing the United States of being actually the source via a U.S. serviceman, as I understand it. That kind of accusation, that kind of tension and friction, can conceivably turn into something more serious.
What's been happening with China since the coronavirus really began is really quite remarkable. If you look back during January, when the outbreak was at its worst in China, there were some commentators who looked and wondered, could this even mean the end of the Communist Party, or certainly something that would loosen the grip of the Communist Party, because it had clearly permitted that disease to get out of control initially, out of a concern for what it would look like publicly. And the public noticed that. They rebelled against that. Now, of course, through incredibly draconian means that I don't think you could really duplicate in any democracy in the United States, they have apparently brought it under control. And they've somehow turned what was a huge mistake into what looks like a propaganda coup that only grows with every day that the U.S., for instance, continues to fail, really, to respond to this. And it's really hard, at this point at least, to look at those two countries and wonder who's the true global leader. I mean, right now, China's actually out sending medical aid to Italy. And meanwhile, here in the U.S., we can't seem to get it together to figure out how to protect ourselves. And I think that's something that could last, really. The country that ultimately responds best to this horrific event, that's going to be a huge victory going forward. And right now, China, surprisingly, has jumped to the lead. And I think if you see comments like that one about the supposed origin to this disease, which, by the way, has no basis in reality whatsoever, this disease came, as we expect, from an animal, moved to a human being. That's exactly what we would expect to see. That will cause more tension going forward, and adding to a great deal of tension that already exists between China and the U.S.
I'm wondering also whether far-right leaders in other countries are opportunistically feeling quite happy that they have an excuse to tighten borders, for example.
I mean, it's certainly been interesting to see that happening. Here in the U.S., it seemed as if that was really the Trump administration's only move, to look to tighten travel restrictions whenever possible. And now, there is some logic to that, especially in the early stages of an outbreak, where you may be able to slow the number of cases coming into your country. At this point, especially in the U.S., it's clear this disease is spreading fairly widely in the community. It's not going to really make a difference preventing people coming, say, from Europe or elsewhere. But yes, I mean, there's something about this that just makes far-right leaders sort of, light up, because they know that they can use this to advance their arguments that you have to shut down borders, you have to focus on your own country. But the problem is, this is also an incredibly global threat, and there's no real way to deal with this except as a unified world. We're vulnerable by those interconnections that can't be stopped. It's really necessary that we come together as we figure out how best to stop this, how best to slow it. Because, of course, because the disease is contagious, if it spreads out of control in one country, it does represent a threat to every other country. There's really no way to stop the movement of microbes, and we need to realize that now. Our citizens really need to realize that.
We are in this together. Thank you, Brian. Brian Walsh, the future correspondent for Axios.